Liberals love to tell us that President Barack Obama is the smartest guy in the room, the smartest guy in the country, the smartest guy of the century, the smartest guy ever to occupy the White House. He's so intellectually deep and well-educated and nuanced and all those other things. You know, those idiots like George W. Bush and Michelle Bachmann and Sarah Palin, all those stupid right-wing bloggers and pundits, they don't know anything. It's Barack Obama who's the genius. Let's have a listen of the intellectual depth of President Obama.
It costs, when, if you, they just gave, you gave him treatment early, and they got some treatment and a breathalyzer, or an inhalator, not a breathalyzer. I haven't had much sleep in the last 48 hours, so. What they'll say is, well, it costs too much money. But you know what? It would cost about the same as what we would spend it, over the course of 10 years. It would cost what it would cost us. All right. Okay. We're going to. It would cost us about the same as it would cost for about, hold on 1 second. I can't hear myself. But I'm glad you're fired up, though. I'm glad.
I'm trying to think, but nothing happens.
Confidentially, might not be a bad idea to demote him to a delivery boy.
Ah, yes, the intellect of Barack Obama, our president. My friends, welcome to the Daily Gator Radio Show, also known as If You're Left, You Just Ain't Right. A bit of a name change, a bit of a start of some other changes here. I'll get into those as time goes on, but lots to get to this week. Stay tuned, strap in. It's going to be lots and lots of fun. Stay with us. And welcome, my friends, to If You're Left, You Just Ain't Right, the Daily Gator Radio Show. I am your host, Doug Hagan. I am the proprietor of the Daily Gator. Blog at dailygator.wordpress.com. Edward Daly is my partner in crime there. At least partner in crime, according to what liberals have to say about us. And I wanted to do a little change on this show. Change a name, change some of the things we do. Maybe have some more funny bits involved. I get Ed to help me or do some little funny bits, maybe some parodies, throw in here or there. It's just part of the natural evolution of this show. But I'm still going to talk a lot about the news, obviously, and issues, throw in some sports, throw in some, yes, weird sex stories will not go away, you perverts. Speaking of perverts, let's talk about Tim Geithner. TurboTax Timmy. He had an interesting exchange with a Republican representative from North Carolina, Renee Elmers. She was questioning Geithner about the economy, economic issues. And from CNN News, we get this. Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner told the House Small Business Committee on Wednesday that the Obama administration believes taxes on small businesses must increase so the administration does not have to shrink the overall size of government programs. In other words, instead of cutting back spending, cutting back entitlement programs, cutting back waste and fraud of the government, we're going to break the backs of small businesses, which will further break the backs of this economy. And people still question. People still question me when I say this president, this administration is about destroying this economic, the economy of this country. How can you see it any other way? We're beyond the point of asking if Obama is truly this stupid. He's not. He knows what he's doing. And how many times during the 2008 campaign did Barack Obama say he wanted to fundamentally transform or fundamentally change America? Guess what? This is the neo-Marxism he wants. He wants bigger government, and it's got to come at a cost, and the cost is going to be businesses. They're going to be having their backs broken. Now back to the story. The administration's plan to raise the tax rate on small businesses is part of its plan to raise taxes on all Americans who have the audacity and the gall to make more than $250,000 per year, including businesses that file taxes the same way individuals and families do. In other words, really small businesses. Because when you get much bigger as a company, you just can't file taxes that way anymore. Now, Geithner's explanation of the administration's small business tax plan came in an exchange with the first-term representative Renee Elmers, Republican in North Carolina. Elmers, a former nurse, decided to run for the U.S. House in 2010 after she became active in the grassroots opposition to Obama's health care plan. In other words, she's a Tea Party candidate, one of those that the media said none of them won. She's one of the ones that didn't win that won. Overwhelmingly, the business back home and across the country continue to tell us that regulation, lack of access to capital, taxation, fear of taxation, and just the overwhelming uncertainties that our businesses face is keeping them from hiring, Elmers told Geithner. They just simply cannot. She then challenged Geithner on the administration's tax plan. Looking into the future, you are supporting the idea of taxation, increasing taxes on those who make $250,000 or more. Those are our business owners, said Elmers. Now, Geithner initially responded by saying the administration's planned tax increase would hit only 3% of your small businesses. Elmers then said 64% of the jobs that are created in this country are from small businesses. Geithner conceded that point, but then suggested the administration's planned tax hike on small businesses would be good for growth. Taking money from small businesses will help them grow somehow. No, it will help government grow, which is what the Obama administration is all about. No, that's right. I agree with that, said Geithner. But just to put it in perspective, it's important to recognize why we are doing this. You know, our deficits are 10% of the GDP, higher than they've been any time in the post-war period, really. Post-World War II, he's talking about. We have a big hole to dig out of, and we have to figure out how to do that in a way that's balanced, good for growth, and fair to people as a whole. Here we get into the taxation as a way to impart and enforce someone in government's definition of fairness. Think back. The debates, the Democratic debates, 2008. Sam Donaldson, I believe it was. I may be wrong about that. No. It was someone from ABC News. Cannot think of his name. Not Sam Donaldson. Ask Obama about raising the capital gains tax. And he says, look, historically, when capital gains taxes, the rate is decreased, the revenues go up. Conversely, when the rate is reduced or increased, revenues go down. So are you going to continue with Obama's plan to raise the rate of capital gains tax? Obama starts talking about being fair. It's fair that some pay more than others. This is redistribution of wealth, the center, the backbone, the centerpiece, the cornerstone of this administration's economic policy. Healthcare is all about redistributing wealth. So is everything else this clown is doing in office. This cannot happen. This is going to kill this economy. Absolutely kill this economy. And it's already working with devastating effects. Unemployment has not gone down. It's gone up. Remember, we had to have the stimulus package because we just can't have unemployment grow above 8%. It's above 10%. Oftentimes, above 9% right now. This is about fundamentally changing this country. Fundamental change. We never knew what it meant. I did. I feared what it would be. It turns out I was right. But a lot of people just went out and voted for that hope and change. They had no idea what was coming. Now, Geithner later said, we're not doing it because we want to do it. We're doing it because if we don't do it, then again, I have to go out and borrow $1 trillion over the next 10 years to finance those tax benefits for the top 2%. And I don't think I can justify doing that. You see, nothing in this guy's spiel about cutting spending. He's going to break the back of every American if he has to keep the government big. It's just that way. Now let's look at another way this administration is kicking our economy in the nuts daily. From John Stossel. He has a blog, a page on Fox Business. Drowning in Rules is the title of it. And he starts off, I got another chain email recently, this one highlighting the wordiness of today's bureaucracy. The Lord's Prayer, 70 words. The Ten Commandments, 331 words. The Declaration of Independence, 1,322 words. The United States Constitution, 7,794 words. Government regulations on the sale of cabbage, 26,911 words. Ha ha, Ross Stossel writes, good point, except the last example isn't true, as Snopes revealed. But it would be true had the email just substituted cheese for cabbage. The FDA devotes 34,823 words to the regulation of cheese. Other agencies add more words and we end up with contradictory rules. The ones that tell us to eat fewer dairy products, but also to eat more cheese. And yet they keep adding more words. It's strangulation by regulation, by taxation. Exactly what Herman Cain has talked about. Too many shuns, regulation, taxation, strangulation, crushing our economy. The government's too big. You know, one of the best things that could be done by any governor of any state or the president would be to get with the legislature, the state legislature, or get with Congress and say, look, we've got enough laws. We've got enough legislation. In fact, we've got way, 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 way too much. I want, insert your name, state's name here, the legislature of this state to start repealing some of these contradictory laws, some of these repetitive laws. I want to get done with that stuff. I want to get it off the books because it is killing us. It's killing the entrepreneurship of this country. It's killing our ability to function as a society. Absolutely it is. It brings me to another point. Rick Perry, the Texas governor, is all but assured to get into the race now, the presidential race. And he took some criticism for a bill he vetoed recently. There was a bill that worked its way through the Texas House and Texas Senate that would have forbidden, banned texting while driving. It also would have banned talking on your cell phone while driving. Had some other measures in there too. Governor Perry said, look, I think this is dangerous, texting while driving. Obviously it is, but I cannot sign this bill because it's an overreach of the government. In other words, we don't need our government in our car telling us every move to make. He was absolutely right on principle. But someone on a sports radio show attacked him because, in his mind, how can you veto it? Because texting while driving is bad. So we can never veto a bill that bans it. Well, I'm sorry, but a policeman can see you. Right now, if they pass you and you're driving in a distracted fashion, they can pull you over and give you tickets. If you really want to address the problem, maybe you should not look at banning something. Maybe you should look at increasing the penalty. Maybe make someone who's caught texting while driving. Say a policeman sees you texting while driving, you're not paying attention, pull you over. How about you lose your license for a few months? How about you go to jail for 30 days? How about all sorts of options? But too many people just want another law, which doesn't do a damn thing but reduce our liberty and squeeze our liberty a little more. It doesn't do anything to address the real problem. And Governor Perry was absolutely right on principle. We do not need the government in our car with us. The government, in all its fashions and forms, is too much a part of our lives now. We have got to change the culture in this country and get away from the entitlement mentality and get away from the government is your mommy and your daddy. If you want to do something, increase the penalty. Don't write another law that's hard to enforce. Should be simple. But again, politicians are, well, they're more simple than that, I guess. A little bit lighter news. How about a psychic sheep? No, this sheep has not revealed to me the winning lotto numbers. But this sheep apparently spied its shepherd's cancer. That's right. Emma Turner believes her life was saved by a sheep headbutting her in the chest. This is from Reuters, by the way. Emma Turner was trying to give Alfie, the psychic sheep, his medication when he repeatedly headbutted her in the chest. The 5-year-old Cotswold, which is normally well-behaved, had to be held down by Miss Turner and two others. Now, when the lady went, Miss Turner went to get the resulting bruises checked by a doctor, she was found to be in the early stages of breast cancer. The doctors and nurses said that if Alfie hadn't done what he did when he did it, I would not have found the lump for a few years, by which time it would have spread, said the 41-year-old woman. Everyone at the hospital is convinced that Alfie saved my life. Well, good for Alfie. Whether this was dumb luck or whether the sheep some dogs can do this, they say. Some dogs can sniff out certain things that are wrong with people physically, they believe. So good work for Alfie the sheep. We're proud of you, Alfie. Very proud. Now, something not to be proud of, in any way, shape, form, or fashion, is the current police chief of Chicago. He went on a rant recently, and he blamed inner-city gun violence on Sarah Palin and the National Rifle Association. Now, in Chicago right now, there's a real problem with gangs of... And I'm going to do something the media won't do. The media will say youths or disaffected youths. Or I'm going to call it like it is, because in this case, this is what it is. There's kind of a rash of white people being attacked by gangs, mobs of black youths, and beaten up, robbed, etc., etc., etc. But, according to the new police chief there, from the Say Anything blog, by the way, this clown suggested that gun rights, listen, gun rights, the Second Amendment, is a form of racism. Government-sanctioned racism. From WLS in Chicago, Chicago's new top cop says the accessibility to firearms in America is an extension of government-sponsored racism that goes back to the days of slavery and Jim Crow. Speaking to parishioners at St. Sabina Church earlier this month, Chicago Police Superintendent Gary McCarthy took to the microphone after Father Michael Flager spoke about gun control. Now, Flager is a far, far left nutcase. Big buddy with Jeremiah Wright. Big buddy of our current president. What a shock. Our president knows another radical leftist. So here's what I want to tell you. See, let's see if we can make a connection here. Slavery, segregation, black codes, Jim Crow, what? What did they all have in common? Anybody getting scared? Government-sponsored racism. Now, I want you to connect one more dot on that chain of the African-American history in this country. And tell me if I'm crazy. Federal gun laws that facilitate the flow of illegal firearms into our urban centers across the country that are killing our black and brown children. the NRA does not like me, and I'm okay with that. We've got to get the gun debate back to center. And it's got to come with a recognition of who's paying the price for the gun manufacturers being rich and living in gated communities, McCarthy said. Now, McCarthy illustrated this point by recalling a crime scene investigation while he was a police official in New York, where five children were shot, two of whom were killed. McCarthy said when he got home, he turned on his TV to unwind and find an episode of Sarah Palin's Alaska showing. She was caribou hunting and talking about the right to bear arms. Why wasn't she at the crime scene with me? Probably because she was killing a caribou, sir. You can't be in Chicago and Alaska at the same time. You, on the other hand, can be on the other side of reality all the time, apparently. You see, you're just a racist if you own a gun now, I guess. And somehow the epidemic of black gangs beating up white people is the fault of government racism against blacks. Filling up these inner city communities with guns. It's like that old argument that the inner cities are being infiltrated by malt liquor and drugs to kill black people. Mr. McCarthy, if a black person never picks up a gun and commits a crime, never commits a violent act, never takes drugs or does anything wrong, that would be a very short-lived government conspiracy, wouldn't it? Of course it would. Just more of the left and their incessant race baiting. Truly despicable. And do yourself a favor, Google or Bing Michael Flager. This guy is a Catholic priest. He is a nutcase right there with Jeremiah Wright and right there with this McCarthy clown and a lot of other buddies such as Bill Ayers and Bernadine Dorn, big fans and buddies with Barack Obama. Again, the radical connections Obama has is amazing. And why the media never looked into it is amazing. And back to the economy really quick. We're paying the price for electing a radical Marxist. That's right, I said radical Marxist. Now, Marxist is radical. I think our president's more radical than your garden variety Marxist. I think this is his agenda. Go back to the anti-Israeli stance he's taken. This guy is radical. He's dangerous. We have to get him out of office in November 2012 so we can have time to pack his bags and leave Washington January 20th, 2013. That will be a great day. Speaking of, I don't know if this makes it a great day, but speaking of, well, radicals, controversy, Hillary Clinton, her senior advisor, has praised a Marxist mass murderer, Che Guevara. Che is the guy you see on all the T-shirts, the bumper stickers, his image there, and it's odd because I remember seeing Carlos Santana wearing a Che chic we have, the Che T-shirt at one of the music awards ceremony, and he's just one of where he's up there with his Che shirt on. You know, the of all the people that Che Guevara had killed, artists, musicians were some of his favorite targets to butcher. And here's this idiot, Carlos Santana, one of the most gifted guitarists, musicians of all time. He's phenomenal. But this guy doesn't understand history. And it's important to note that you can be talented, you can be a lot of ways a good person, but if you don't know your history and don't have a grasp, and you just kind of live on the fringes of reality, and you hear, you know, see a bunch of people wearing Che shirts, and, well, he's a great guy, he was this, he was that, the Motorcycle Diaries, remember that movie was about him. Pretty soon you're wearing the shirt yourself, and you're celebrating someone who would have likely killed you if you had been unfortunate enough to live in Cuba at the time he was doing his stuff. But back to Hillary Clinton's senior advisor, via the Gateway Pundit and the Daily Gator blog, Edward Daly found this. Great. Another commie-praising idiot in the Obama administration. Hillary Clinton's senior advisor, Alec Ross, praised social media and the internet as the Che Guevara of the 21st century. I guess that means, as one blogger opined, that the internet's going to be shot to death in Bolivia one day, because that's how Che met his end. Che Guevara was a communist, a murderer, a thug, and a coward. Now, the Young Americas Foundation has a video out there you can find on YouTube and on the Daily Gator of individuals, plus thousands more, that were murdered by Che and the Cuban revolutionaries. Leftist idiots want to compare the internet revolution to the communist revolution that destroyed Cuba. See, again, a lack of education, a lack of common sense, a lack of an ability to grasp history and do just basic study and research on somebody before you start wearing their t-shirt around or start throwing their name around like they're some heroic figure. Now, The Guardian's where the story originally came from. Hillary Clinton's senior advisor for innovation at the U.S. State Department has lauded the way the internet has become the Che Guevara of the 21st century in the Arab Springs uprising. Speaking at The Guardian's Activate Summit in London on Wednesday, Alec Ross said, "Dictatorships are now more vulnerable than ever. As disaffected citizens organize influential protest movements on Facebook and Twitter." Of course, the odd thing is that he's celebrating a would-be dictator, a man who helped a dictator named Castro, and comparing him favorably to the internet somehow. It's leftist. They have nothing between their ears. They do not think. They feel. They emote. The U.S. has pledged to back the pro-democracy movement that have swept the Middle East and North Africa since January. Ross welcomed the redistribution of power from autocratic regimes to individuals, describing the internet as wildly disruptive during the protest in Egypt and Tunisia. Dictatorships are now vulnerable than they've ever been before, in part but not entirely because of the devolution of power from the nation-state to the individual. One thesis statement I want to emphasize is how networks disrupt the exercise of power. They devolve power, from the nation state, from governments and large institutions, to individuals and small institutions. The overreaching pattern is the redistribution of power from government and large institutions to people and small institutions. Now, again, understand who is taking over in Egypt is the Muslim Brotherhood. They're going to be as bad as any dictator you ever heard of. These are not good people, the Muslim Brotherhood. It's amazing to me. There's no comprehension of Che Guevara for what he was, a murderous thug. There's no comprehension of what's happening in some of these revolts. Just because a dictator is overthrown doesn't necessarily mean the people coming in behind him aren't as bad or worse. I look at how Egypt, Mubarak may have been a bastard, but he wasn't the kind of bastard a Muslim Brotherhood will be if they get in charge. And the threat to Israel will be greater. The oppression of women will be greater in Egypt. The rise of Sharia law, I'm sure, will follow. A lot of bad things will happen in Egypt because Mubarak's gone. Not that Egypt was a paradise before. But again, just because you have the word revolution thrown around doesn't mean it's good revolution. Doesn't mean it's positive change. Doesn't mean it's good change. Not at all. Terrifying. Speaking of being terrified, when we get back from a little musical break, a tune called Chasing Rain by Lehigh, a little Irish music for you. I'll put you in the mood. I found this the other day because my niece is always coming up to me when I'm on the computer. Horse. She wants to see pictures of horses. And I remember this video from Lehigh called Chasing Rain. Lots of it is these horses running in the rain while this great Irish music's playing in the back. So I was looking for that video, and I remembered, and I said, I'm going to put that on my next show. So I did, and it's now here, and you'll hear it in about a minute here. And I want to thank everybody who listens to these podcasts, all my podcasts. And I want to thank everybody for listening to me when I was on Chimpsy Radio Network, which I may or may not be on again at some point. But I want to thank everybody. It is tremendous. My blog, The Daily Gator, has been growing and growing and growing the past 2 months. Very pleased with that, and I want to keep it going. And that's part of the reason I'm going to start referring to this show as The Daily Gator Radio Show. Because I think Ed Daly and myself have something to offer in a way of content that that maybe a lot of others don't. Something you don't get on the regular talk radio, through the blog and through this show and these podcasts. Hopefully we can affect some positive change in this country. Now, some music. I'll be back. Welcome back, my friends. Chasing Rain, Lehigh. Great, great tune. Great video, too. Now, earlier in this show, I referenced Barack Obama back in the 2008 presidential debate, the Democratic debate, being questioned about raising the capital gains rate, capital gains tax rate. It was Charles Gibson who asked the question. I had a brain fart. I couldn't remember at the moment, but it was Charles Gibson. Now, let's look at how your money, my money, our tax dollars are wasted. They're wasted many, many ways, and people often look only at the big things, and they say, well, how are you going to reduce spending? I mean, this doesn't mean this is $3 million, that's $14 million, this is, you know, you throw a few hundred million here, throw a hundred million there, a couple million here, it's pretty soon you start talking about serious money. It's about changing the culture that the government is everything to us and has to spend all kind of money to fix every one of our problems. There's a new ad out from some college Democrats, and it's on YouTube, and I found that the other McCain blog, and these young Democrats who are in college are giving reasons why they're Democrats, and they give the stupid reasons. One is because of the Patriot Act. I don't know if that's pro or con. One is that he wants everyone to have a fair shot, whatever that means. And this one girl actually says, because I think the government has to take care of everybody. Again, be my mommy, be my daddy. That's the liberal mindset. But here's a great example of taxpayer dollars being spent in a way that not only I'm sure would make the founders roll in their grave, but should have all of us up in arms. From the Weasel Zippers blog, also, this was posted on my blog by the Daily Gator, U.S. taxpayers shell out $3.6 million to study monkeys, but not just any monkeys. No, dope-smoking, menstruating monkeys. That's right, dope-smoking monkeys at that time of the month. And we're spending millions of dollars to study them. That may sound bad, but the details are even worse. From CNSNnews.com, the National Institute on Drug Abuse, known as NIDA, a division of the federal government's National Institute of Health, NIH, and there's a problem right there, the alphabet soup. Every government agency had a sub-agency and subcommittees and congressional committees. Absolutely out of control. Absolutely out of control. But the NIDA, a division of the NIH, has spent $3,634,807 over the past decade funding research that involves getting monkeys to, yes, smoke and drink drugs such as PCB, methamphetamines, heroin, and cocaine, and then studying their behavior, including during different phases of the female monkey's menstrual cycles. Wow. Absolutely. Look, I don't know what a monkey does when they smoke cocaine or take meth or drink booze, but I would imagine it's probably not good for the monkey, and a monkey probably freaks out. Hell, the monkey might even be brain damaged enough to vote Democrat after this kind of thing. I don't know, but it doesn't take $3.6 million for me to figure out we shouldn't be doing this in the first place. Where's PETA here? Where are the people who are always ticked off about cruelty to animals? This study also uses interventions and treatment models for monkeys who have been taught to use drugs. So I guess they send them to rehab, and the monkeys then have to cohabitate with the Paris Hiltons, and I guess Anthony Weiner may be in there soon, rehab. Anthony, you know, I think Anthony Weiner will be there smoking crack with the monkeys with his pants around his ankles, taking pictures of himself to tweet young girls. Do we really need to abuse animals by allowing them to be in the presence of Anthony Weiner? Really? Now, precursor research on drug-using monkeys, also funded by NIDA, discovered that after smoking cocaine, listen carefully, revelation here, after smoking cocaine, monkeys exhibited dilated pupils and slightly agitated hyperactive behavior. No shit. Really? What are you going to study next? That teenage boys are attracted to teenage girls, maybe? Or that people that stand in the rain get wet? What's next? Now, this supposedly helped researchers conclude that physiological effects of cocaine on monkeys were similar to those reported in studies on human subjects. Did we really need to know that? No, we didn't. You wonder why these people give me a headache. You wonder why. But there is some lighter news to discuss from the Daily Caller. One of my two weird sex stories. The one for the end of the show was really weird. Okay. This one's kind of pathetically sad and a little bit weird. But from the Daily Caller, a knight in shining armor isn't always the key to a woman's heart. Case in point, Jan Rudnicki, a 40-year-old Polish man. A man named Jan? Wonder if he ever hung out with dope-smoking monkeys. But a 40-year-old Polish man named Jan, who hopped onto a horse and plowed into a female's house in hopes of sweeping her off her feet. According to the Croatian Times, is the Croatian Times affiliated with the New York Times? No, it's not a fish wrap, it's an actual newspaper. Okay, good. According to the Croatian Times, a drunk and shirtless Rudnicki jumped on the equine, who galloped right through Gosia Domoslavska's front door. A man named Jan, in love with a woman named Gosia, rides a horse, shirtless. The man shirtless, not the horse. Horses never wear shirts. I don't think so anyway, do they? I don't know. Maybe for Halloween, or when they're hanging out with dope-smoking monkeys. But he rides this horse to the woman's house to impress her. And yes, there was alcohol involved. Now, at what point does a man reach a point where he goes, well, let me think. I'm really trying to impress this woman. I'll take my shirt off, climb on a horse, and ride the horse through her freaking house. That'll knock her off her feet. That'll sweep her off her feet. As the story continues, as we all know, these sorts of advances aren't well received in instances of unrequited love. So an uninterested Domoslavska called authorities after Rudnicki stormed through her place. The fall savior could spend up to 5 years in jail for aggravated breaking and entering. He's a loon, this woman told the publication. I never fancied him before, and I certainly don't now. If this was supposed to win by heart, he must seriously be off his rocker. Now, Rudnicki's buddy, Marek Nowak, said he didn't think his friend would actually follow through with this horsing around, get it? Horsing around, yeah, whatever. Men, all of us have been in that situation where our love was not returned or affections, desires weren't returned, and that sucks. But if it ever comes to a point where you're telling a friend, you know, I think I'm going to take my shirt off and ride through her house on a horse, don't do it. Have your friend handcuff you to something so you can't do it. And for the love of God, keep him away from cocaine-smoking monkeys. Or researchers who study cocaine-smoking monkeys. Now, one of the big stories this week came out of New York. And the New York State Assembly has legalized gay marriage. Now, those of you who have listened to my show, read my blog, I don't care about gay marriage. I really don't. It's not really on my radar. I don't understand homosexuality. As I've said before, I can't understand two men watching, say, Selma Hayek and Halle Berry mud wrestling and commenting on their outfits or the shoes they have on or something. I would be focused on other things. But I don't care. What my neighbor does in their bedroom is not my business. And I've always been a supporter of civil unions. I don't care if gay couples adopt. If they're a stable couple and they're financially able, you know, it's more important for a child to have a loving family than to have no one. Now, obviously, if there's a heterosexual married couple, yeah, I think that's preferable to a gay couple. But again, I don't see homosexuality as the abomination that some people see it as. And maybe that's my problem. And this is where I disconnect with a lot of social conservatives. But to me, the biggest problem with gay marriage isn't saying this state's going to recognize gay marriage. It's a state legislature that did it. I would prefer a statewide referendum. Let the voters decide. Let the voters decide if they want to recognize civil unions or gay marriage or whatever, marrying unicorns, whatever. Let the state voters decide that. That way you prevent legislatures from ramming things down people's throats they don't want. But the bigger problem is you're going to have people flooding into New York from a neighboring state, getting married, a gay couple, lesbian couple, whatever. Then they're going to try to go back to their state and sue to force that state to recognize their marriage. That's the problem. Too many of the people behind the gay marriage movement are agenda-driven. They want to fundamentally change the definition of marriage. And you're never going to do that. Maybe the answer is getting government completely out of marriage. You know, again, I don't think a married couple should pay less taxes. They should pay I support a flat tax, a fair tax kind of thing. Maybe that's the best answer. And if it gets you fired up and you're angry that New York has, you know, allowed gay marriage now, to me it's a state-by-state decision. I don't think, A, you're ever going to get a constitutional amendment to ban it or define marriage as between one man and one woman. As traditionally, of course, it always will be. And that's the third thing. The attack on anything traditional by the left has always disturbed me. Anything traditional, they want to attack. They want to come after. And it's sad. They shouldn't do that, obviously. But they have a deep-held desire to turn everything upside down in this country somehow. Excuse me. And I don't think this is any different. And again, if it upsets you that I don't get fired up about this, I'm not ranting and raving against it. To me, if the people of New York want this, let the people of New York have that. But understand the inherent problems you're going to get. Any state that passes that, you're going to have people coming in your state, getting married, going back to their state, and then saying, "Hey, we're going to sue if you don't recognize a marriage." Now, another wacky leftist. You remember the book The Color Purple that made a movie out of it? Whoopi Goldberg was in it, I think. Danny Glover, I believe. Anyway, the woman who wrote The Color Purple is named Alice Walker. Now, I didn't know anything about Alice Walker except her name until this Friday afternoon. That's where I read the story of an interview she did with Foreign Policy magazine. Interesting piece from this interview with Alice Walker. Apparently this new blockade buster into Gaza that the left is doing, the pro-Palestinian, the pro-terrorist people, she's going to be on that boat. Now, she is a Pulitzer Prize winner. She's going to join the flotilla of ships next week that will try to break Israel's maritime blockade of the Gaza Strip. Gaza is blockaded by the Israeli Navy for one reason. Israel doesn't mind supplies, humanitarian, medical, food, etc., etc., coming to Gaza. But since a lot of countries and terrorists ship in weapons to be fired at Israel to target Israeli civilians, Israel blockades. So they can inspect and make sure what's getting into Gaza. So the whole purpose of the blockade is not to deny anybody food or medicine or supplies. It is to protect Israel. And Israel is perfectly right to do it. But Alice Walker says the goal is to bring supplies and raise awareness of the situation in Gaza. Now, Foreign Policy starts off the magazine by asking this question. Why are you taking part in this mission? Walker responds, in 2009, I was in Gaza just after Operation Cast Lead, and I saw the incredible damage and devastation. Now, if you remember what happened last year, in 2010, the last time they tried this, the Israeli Defense Forces had to go in, the commandos, and enforce blockade. They boarded the ship. They were attacked, brutally attacked. With deadly force, they responded. 9 scumbags, pro-terrorist scumbags were killed. And, of course, the left tried to play it up as, oh, see, these Israeli commandos just went crazy and started killing innocent people. Hardly the case. Hardly the case. Israel was acting in self-defense, as Israel always does in these situations. Now, Walker says, I have a good understanding on what's on the ground there and how the water system was destroyed and the sewage system. I saw that the ministries had been bombed and the hospitals had been bombed and the schools. I sat for a good part of a morning in the rubble of the American school. It was just so painful there because we Americans pay so much for our taxes for this kind of weaponry that was used. Well, Israel only bombs in retaliation. They only try to get the terrorists, and the terrorists hide where, Miss Walker? Deliberately hide in schools and hospitals. Or they would not surprise me to find out they blow it up themselves and then call the media and say, look what the Israelis did. Because they're lying scumbags. This is Hamas you're talking about. Terrorists, Ms. Walker, they're terrorists. Foreign policy then asks, how long have you been involved in Palestinian activism? What drew you to it? Walker responds, it started with this Six-Day War in 1967 that happened shortly after my wedding to a Jewish law student. We were very happy because we thought Israel was right to try to defend itself by preemptively striking against Egypt. We didn't realize the real history of that area. So that was my beginning of being interested in what was going on and watching what was happening. Even at that time, I said to my young husband, well, they shouldn't take that land because it's actually not their land. This has seemed unjust to me. It just seemed wrong. It's really unjust because in America, we think about Israel in mythical terms. And most of us have grown up with the Bible. So we think that we are sort of akin to these people. Whatever they're saying must be true. Their God is giving them land, and that's just the reality. But actually, the land had people living on it. The people were in their homes, their own towns and cities. So the battle has been about them trying to reclaim what was taken from them. It's important when we have some new understanding, especially adults and mature adults, we must, I think, take some action so that younger people have a better understanding of what they are seeing in the world. In other words, she's eaten up the BS that the Palestinian terrorists have given her. This is all Israel taking land that wasn't there and being oppressive. Now, then foreign policy asks, is the goal of this mission, though, just to raise awareness, or is it actually to deliver supplies? She says, well, our boat is delivering letters, so what we're trying to draw attention to is the fact that the blockade is still in effect. On the other boats, there will probably be supplies. I haven't checked, but possibly things like sewage supplies. So she doesn't even know what's on these ships. It's just a publicity stunt. Foreign policy then points out that Egypt has partially reopened its borders with Gaza, so couldn't you get the supplies in through there? Walker replies, no, you can't. You can get two suitcases. Not only that, they closed it. They opened it and then they closed it. So that has to be worked out. Well, she might want to know why Egypt closed the border. She might want to question that. But then Foreign Policy magazine asked this. Israel's ambassador to the United Nations said the stated goal of humanitarian assistance was a false pretext for your mission. And it's actually designed to serve as an extremist political agenda, and that many of the groups participating in the mission maintain ties with extremist and terrorist organizations, including Hamas. Your reaction? And this is where she really exposes herself. I think Israel is the greatest terrorist in that part of the world. And I think, in general, the United States and Israel are great terrorist organizations themselves. If you go to Gaza and see some of the bombs, what's left of the bombs that were dropped, and the general destruction, you would have to say, yeah, it's terrorism. When you terrorize people, when you make them so afraid of you that they are just mentally and psychologically wounded for life, that's terrorism. So these countries are terrorist countries. Then Foreign Policy responds, how is the United States a terrorist country? It is. Absolutely it is. It has terrorized people around the globe for a very long time. It has fought against countries that have tried to change their governments, that have tried to have democracies, and the United States has intervened and interfered, like in Guatemala or Chile. I feel that it's so unreasonable. I don't quite understand how they can claim everyone else is a terrorist and that they're not, when so many people right this minute are terrified by the drones, for instance, in the war in Afghanistan, the dropping of bombs on people. Isn't that terrorism? We're killing terrorists, Ms. Walker. That's who's afraid of the drones, or terrorists, Al-Qaeda. People who would cut your freaking head off as soon as look at you. You stupid, stupid woman. Then Foreign Policy Magazine points out that Israel and the U.S. aren't the only ones using bombs. Hamas repeatedly fires rockets in Israel. Walker responds, yes, I'm not for a minute saying anybody anywhere should fire rockets. I mean, I would never do it, nor would I ever supply such a thing to anyone. But it's extremely unequal. Here we go with this argument, this idiotic argument. If people just acknowledge how absurdly unequal this is David and Goliath, but Goliath is not the Palestinians. They are David. They are the ones with slingshots. They are the ones with rocks and relatively not so powerful rockets. Whereas the Israelis have these incredibly damaging missiles and rockets. When do you, as a person of conscience, speak and say enough is enough? Well, I'm going to say enough's enough on your stupidity, Miss Walker. Israel wants nothing but peace. Every time Israel makes any concessions, they are greeted with further rockets attacks, further homicide bombers, walking into school buses and blowing themselves up. The Palestinians aren't doing this because they're fighting for their survival. They're doing it because Hamas, in its charter, Hamas runs the Gaza Strip now, you know. They want Israel wiped off the face of the map, Miss Walker. You cannot be that stupid. You cannot be that stupid. Or maybe she is. Maybe she is. And now, one quick note before I get to my weird sex story. From my blog, The Daily Gator. I talked to you earlier that Rick Perry is almost certainly going to get into the race for president. Now, how will the left react? Well, they've already started. They've already started. Rush Limbaugh was talking about this. The America's not ready for another Texas governor as president theory. You're going to hear that a lot. And then you had Chris Matthews at MSNBC. I don't know what he was trying to say, but he was looking at a speech that the Texas governor recently gave, and he's making some hand gestures and speaking in an animated fashion because he has charisma and is a truly good speaker, unlike Chris Matthews. But Chris Matthews trying to make the point that Perry's hands, his hand motions, that's not what a real conservative would do. A real conservative would do something else. I don't know. But that's the memo. But there's something else. Apparently, according to the other McCain blog, they're going to Twitter, the left has, and they're afraid enough of Rick Perry, terrified by him. They're going to go homophobic on him. Someone posted on Twitter some gay rumors about Rick Perry. And Stacey McCain writes, my reaction on Twitter last night was brief and blunt. It is astounding that they do this, and I'd rather ignore it altogether, but now the desperate and ridiculous gay smear against Rick Perry has been promoted at both Politico and New York Magazine. Isn't it interesting how so many high-minded journalists who sneered at the Anthony Weiner scandal is an absurd distraction from the real issues? An attitude that just coincidentally reprised Weasel's original defense against accusations that later proved entirely true, are now willing to lend credence to mere rumors which are not only unsubstantiated but also highly implausible. There isn't any reason at all to believe this smear, so why is it necessary to recycle it? Because they're afraid. They smell blood and water, and the blood they smell is their own. They see Rick Perry's economic record. They see Obama's. They see the economy the number one issue, and they're doing something in their pants that they shouldn't be doing right now over it. And this is desperation. And good. Keep being desperate. Keep acting like a bunch of radical nutbags, and your chosen one will be out in 2013. And Rick Perry, I think that's your next president. I'll predict that right now. Now, the weird sex story of the week. Mummy, listen to this headline. This is just absolutely priceless. Mummy, that woman's doing push-ups on that man. A couple has been jailed for sex on the beach in front of horrified families. And you have to say horrified like that. You can't just say horrified. You have to accentuate it. You have to let people know they were horrified. A couple have been jailed for having sex on a beach in full view of dozens of families. Lita Dawson and her boyfriend, Nicholas Harrison, both 51, were spotted on top of each other at Seaford Beach in East Sussex. was in Australia, by the way. 1 5-year-old boy told his shocked mother, "Mummy, that lady was doing push-ups on that man." Good Lord. And look, if you're 51, you want to have sex, great, fine. Don't do it in public. For God's sakes, no one wants to see that. Really. That could damage his 5-year-old psyche. He could ruin sex for him. 51-year-old people should never be naked. Unless it's completely dark in the privacy of their own home. As long as no dope-smoking monkeys are around. That is the show for this week, my friend. The 54th edition of If You're Left, You Do Say It Right. And the first edition of the Daily Gator Radio Show. God bless you for listening. Thank you very much. Remember, if you're left, you truly just are not right. Remember the blog, thedailygator.wordpress.com. I will talk to y'all next Wednesday evening. And when this will debut here at Podomatic, dailygator.podomatic.com, on my blog, The Daily Gator, and it'll be on Facebook and Twitter. All places you can see it. Good night. God bless. Thank you for listening. I'll talk to y'all soon.